The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Anna Mateo, Alice Bryant, and John Russell. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Anna Mateo.
Declared dead by a French court in 2017, Jean Pouchon has spent the past 4 years trying to prove she is alive. French officials, however, disagree. My name was Jean. It is still Jean, after I've been declared dead in 2017, said the 59-year-old. She cries at times when explaining her story and what she plans for when she will officially be alive again. It all started, Pouchon said, when the family received a letter 4 years ago from a court saying mistakenly that she was dead. The letter also said she owed money that her husband had to pay. The letter was part of a legal process launched by a former employee of Pouchon's cleaning business. It has not been easy or quick to fix the mistake. Pouchon is unable to work and afraid to leave her house because she does not have an identification card or social security number. She lives as a recluse. Some of the family's belongings were taken by the courts, and all their saved money has gone to trying to get things back to normal. My life, well, it's nothing. I feel I'm of no use. I'm nothing and I'm of no use. And this is hard, Pouchon said. She spoke to Reuters in the house she shares with her husband, Pierre Jean, in a small village near Lyon in southeast France. Now the courts are looking at her case again. Pouchon and her husband have begun to have some hope, but it will still take months. The courts must overturn their decision, and a judge must recognize, officially, that she is not dead, and never was. She has great dreams for that day. I know exactly what I will do. I will get a health check, because I know some things are wrong with my body, she said. She said that she could not see a doctor because she does not have a social security number. She has several health problems, including having lost most of her teeth. I would so love to be able to bite into an apple. I would love to have teeth. I would be so happy, even if they were to give me 2 dentures. I would be happy to have teeth. Her other dream is simply to be able to enjoy life again, at home, with her husband, Pierre Jean. He is sure things will be put right. Hope is what makes us carry on, he said. Eventually, the outcome will necessarily be in our favor. I'm Anna Mateo.
South Korea lawmakers approved a law on Tuesday banning app stores from controlling how apps and their services are paid for. South Korea is reportedly the first country in the world to pass such a law. Technology companies Google and Apple operate profitable app stores. They require app makers to use their payment systems. Google and Apple have faced a lot of criticism for their requirements on payment systems. That is because they get up to 30% of the money from the sales in their app stores. They say that the money helps pay for the cost of operating these stores. Google's Google Play and Apple's App Store are used by people around the world. The new South Korean law prevents app stores from using their strong market positions to require use of their payment systems. Instead, they must let app makers give the public additional ways to pay. South Korea says the ban is aimed at supporting fairer competition. The law also aims to prevent retaliation against app makers by banning app stores from unreasonably delaying app approval. Apple criticized the law in a statement Tuesday. It said the law will put users who purchase digital goods with other payment methods at risk of fraud. The company also said the law would weaken users' privacy protections and make it hard to oversee their purchases. And Apple said it will make parental controls and other tools less effective. The company said user trust in app store purchases will decrease and lead to fewer opportunities for Korean app developers. The new law will also let Korean officials examine app markets to find disputes and stop actions that block fair competition. Officials in Europe, China, and other places worry about the market control of Apple, Google, and similar companies. That includes their control over payment systems, online advertisements, and other things. Chinese officials have fined some companies for breaking rules meant to prevent monopolies. Other governments are trying to decide how best to keep markets competitive. The Korea Internet Corporations Association is an industry group. Its members include South Korea's largest internet companies, such as Naver, a search engine and online shopping service. Naver welcomed the passage of the law and said it would create healthier competition. The company also said it would give users more choices at lower prices. Google said it is considering how to obey the new law. Google Play provides far more than payment processing, and the service cost helps keep Android free, the company said in a statement. Android is Google's operating system for smartphones. The company said it gives developers the tools to reach a market of billions of people around the world. And just as it costs developers money to build an app, it costs us money to build and keep an operating system and app store, Google said. Recently, Apple announced It will let makers of iPhone apps tell users about low-cost ways to buy digital subscriptions and media. That decision was part of a legal case involving iPhone app developers in the U.S. I'm Alice Bryant.
This report represents the 300th Everyday Grammar program. In celebration of the event, we will explore common phrasal verbs that have to do with the development of everyday grammar reports. What you learn will be useful for discussing any kind of planning or problem solving. Let's begin with a few important terms and ideas. Phrasal verbs are groups of words that have a verb and another short word or words. Together, these word groups take on a meaning that is different from what the individual words suggest. For example, consider the phrasal verb go on. The verb go is followed by the short word on. Together, these words can mean to happen or take place. Some common phrasal verbs describe how VOA Learning English develops each week's everyday grammar report. These phrases are useful for describing planning and problem solving in general. Let's explore each of these phrasal verbs. The first step in every week's report involves the phrasal verb figure out. The writer figures out, or develops an understanding of, a subject. Reader questions, news reports, grammar books, and friendly suggestions all play a part in the development of everyday grammar reports. The phrasal verb figure out even appears at our meetings, as in, have you figured out an everyday grammar topic for next week? The second step in every program involves the writer working out the idea for the story. In this case, the phrasal verb work out means to plan or think carefully about the story in detail. For example, the writer might need to work out a way to include some fun audio examples from movies, songs, or news reports. Or, the writer might need to work out a way to explain a complex grammar subject in a clear way. After working out a plan for the report, the third step is to go ahead with the report. Go ahead means to carry out an action. For example, after discussing ideas and plans for a story, a VOA worker at a meeting might say, "You should go ahead with that story." After the report is published, the writer looks back at the report and reader comments. The phrasal verb look back means to think of something again, or to reconsider something after a period of time. This is an important step for understanding the strengths and weaknesses of the report. This step also helps the writers develop new ideas for future reports. While today's report explained the steps taken for everyday grammar programs, the phrasal verbs you learned about are useful to describe all kinds of problem-solving activities. A person might, for example, figure out the size of a problem, work out a plan to deal with it, go ahead with a plan to solve the problem, and finally, look back at what he or she has done. I'm John Russell.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. The United States declared war on Britain in 1812. It did so because Britain refused to stop seizing American ships that traded with France, Britain's enemy in Europe. Sometimes there were also seizures of American sailors. These seizures were known as impressment. Britain finally suspended its orders against neutral trade after a change in government. But the British acted too late. The United States had already declared war. Today, we continue the story of the War of 1812. Most of Britain's forces were battling the soldiers of Napoleon Bonaparte in Europe. Historian and Pulitzer Prize winner Alan Taylor says that as a result, the British could send only a small force to the United States.
And so the British were basically fighting the war against the United States on the defensive in Canada while trying to raid the American coast, using their advantage in the more powerful Royal Navy.
For its part, the United States was far from ready to fight. The country had not fought a war or needed an army for a long time. There were only 8,000 American soldiers. The soldiers, who were young, knew little about war. And the officers who knew about war were old enough to have led troops in the American Revolution. President James Madison named two top generals, 62-year-old Henry Dearborn and 63-year-old Thomas Pinckney. The United States had only a few warships and gunboats with which to face the British Navy, the most powerful naval force in the world. Historian and professor Alan Taylor says the American people were divided about the war.
A majority of them supported the Madison administration and agreed that they tried the embargo, it had failed, and that something had to be done because national honor, they felt, was at stake, and that they needed to stop the British practice of impressment. And they were also upset about the British military aid to these Indian peoples who were restricting American expansion.
Alan Taylor says, for those reasons, many Americans supported the war, particularly in the southern, western, and mid-Atlantic states.
But in New England, most of the people supported the opposition party, the Federalists, and they were very bitter about the war. They felt that it was really being waged for illegitimate reasons, that diplomacy could have just papered over the disagreement over impressment. And so they did their best to obstruct the war effort. They not only didn't want to contribute to the war effort, but they wanted to block it as best they could.
Church bells were rung and flags were lowered in New England when the declaration of war was announced. There was also the problem of getting enough men to serve as soldiers. Congress had approved an increase of 25,000 men. Only 5,000 agreed to serve. Members of Congress from the western states had spoken proudly of how their people would rush to fight the British. This did not happen. The first request to Kentucky for soldiers produced only 400 men. Historian Alan Taylor says that some states in the Northeast did not offer any soldiers at all, especially for invasions into Canada.
And even when the governors would cooperate, as did, for example, the governor of New York, the militia would often march to the border and then decide that their constitutional duty was only to defend their state and not to help the United States invade another country. And so they'd go on a sit-down strike once they got to the border.
Nevertheless, an American general named William Hull led 2,000 men across the Canadian border. But the British general there was prepared, and the attack failed. Although Hull had the stronger force and plenty of supplies, he retreated to Detroit. He was chased by a smaller force of British soldiers and Indians. After the war, Hull was tried by a military court on charges of cowardice. The court found him guilty and ordered him shot. But President Madison, because of Hull's service during the Revolutionary War, permitted the old soldier to live. The next American attack was made from Fort Niagara, a military post in New York on the shore of Lake Ontario. A small group of American soldiers crossed the Niagara River and attacked the British. But some Americans from New York refused to cross the border to help against the British. They calmly watched as British soldiers shot down the attacking Americans. The third campaign was made by General Henry Dearborn. He led a state militia force from Plattsburgh, New York, to the Canadian border. He was planning to cross the border and attack Montreal. But again, the soldiers refused to cross the border. Dearborn could do nothing but march them back to Plattsburgh. British forces at this time were winning victories. They captured an American fort in northern Michigan, and Indians fighting for the British captured a fort at the place now known as Chicago. Instead of marching through Canada without difficulty, the Americans found themselves trying hard to keep the British out of the state of Ohio. For a while, the small American Navy was doing better than the Army. Just 2 months after the war started, the United States warship Constitution forced a British ship to surrender. Several months later, another American ship, the Wasp, captured the British ship Frolic. Then a frigate named the United States defeated one of Britain's most famous fighting ships, the Macedonian. The British ship was captured and brought to the United States. There were other victories at sea. At the end of 6 months, the United States Navy had captured 6 British ships and lost only one of its own vessels. Private American trade ships had been armed with guns when the war started. They, too, were successful against the British. They captured more than 300 British trade ships. But the American successes forced Britain to bring more of its fighting ships into the war with the United States. By the middle of 1813, a year after the war started, British ships controlled the East Coast. No American ship could enter or leave any port south of New England. Meanwhile, the military situation was improving for the Americans in what was then the West. William Henry Harrison, governor of the Indiana Territory, formed a large force to try to capture Detroit from the British. At the same time, Captain Oliver Perry built 5 warships on Lake Erie. With these, and four he already had, Perry met and defeated a British naval force. Perry reported his victory to Harrison. "We have met the enemy, and they are ours." Perry's victory and Harrison's large force caused the British to withdraw from Detroit and from a British fort at Malden in Canada. Harrison's men continued to chase the enemy. They caught them and defeated them in the Battle of the Tens. Killed in this battle was the great Indian chief Tecumseh, who had been fighting for the British. American forces made new attempts to win control of Lake Ontario and invade Canada across the Niagara River. But none of these succeeded. Late in 1813, British soldiers crossed the river and captured Fort Niagara. They also burned the town of Buffalo. By April 1814, Napoleon was forced from power in Europe, and the war between France and Britain was over. The end of the war in Europe permitted Britain to send many of its soldiers to fight against the United States. About 4,000 British soldiers landed on the Chesapeake coast, southeast of Washington. They met American forces inland at Bladensburg, a town 10 kilometers from Washington. The British soldiers broke through the American lines, and the Americans began to run away. But a group of sailors refused to retreat with their artillery. Commanded by Joshua Barney, the 400 sailors chose to stand and fight. The struggle did not last long against the 4,000 British soldiers. Barney held his position for a half hour before enemy soldiers got behind his men and silenced their guns. Barney was wounded seriously. The British thought so much of his courage that they carried him to a hospital for their own soldiers at Bladensburg. Barney himself said the British officers treated him as a brother. Once the British troops had smashed through Barney's Navy men, nothing stood between them and Washington. The commanders of the British force, General Robert Ross and Admiral George Cockburn, took a group of men to the Capitol building and set fire to it. Then the two commanders went to the White House with the same intention. Before setting fire to the president's home, Cockburn took one of Madison's hats and the seat from one of Dolly Madison's chairs. The admiral found the president's table set for dinner. As a joke, he took a glass of wine and toasted the health of President Jemmy. President Madison had fled the White House. He crossed the Potomac River and started toward his home in Virginia. He joined his wife on the road the second day. They decided to wait about 25 kilometers from Washington. When President Madison returned to the Capitol 3 days later, the British had withdrawn. They had also burned most public buildings.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.